Rick, I am super delighted that we have this opportunity to reconnect and pick up where we left off last time. I know that our conversation last time not only got incredible attention from the many people who listened, but it also got them thinking that this is the first step towards really trying to get closer and understanding who we are as people. So hopefully today we can talk about some things that could help these individuals who are very interested in this topic really expand that level of awareness. So thank you so much.
Oh, fantastic. My pleasure to be here, Mo. It's great.
So I'd like to start, Rick, with just kind of getting current. What's been keeping your attention nowadays?
Good news and bad news. In other words, what I mean by that is that on the one hand, I've been very struck by the power of fear. And in the world altogether, I think the last 10 years in many ways have been a big teach-in, to use that phrase from the 60s, about the power of fear. Certainly in America in the last 10 years, we've been all living in a one long seminar, a very experiential seminar about the way in which threat, actual and imagined, can really grab attention and drive the agenda over and over again, and how that links more broadly, which is the work I've been doing lately, to the ways in which we evolved to be quite anxious and very reactive to any semblance of threat. To bottom line it, basically of the two mistakes you can make in life, one is where you think that there's a tiger in the bushes but about to pounce, but there really is no tiger. Okay? The other mistake is you think the coast is clear, but there really is a tiger there about to get you. And Mother Nature wants us to make the first mistake 1,000 times over to avoid making the second mistake even once. And the problem is that the paper tiger paranoia, quote unquote, which results, makes us routinely overestimate threats, underestimate opportunities, and underestimate resources for dealing with threats and also fulfilling opportunities. And you see this at all levels. You see it individually, you see it in couples, families, organizations. Companies do this routinely. Many companies are threat fixated rather than opportunity fixated. And definitely you see it at the national and international level. So on the one hand, the bad news side is that we are very vulnerable to fear. And so I've put a lot of attention recently in what to do about that, because I'm a, as you know, a methods guy, practical clinician, teacher kind of guy. I consume research voraciously, but I don't produce any, basically. So I thought a lot about how to not be so driven by fear, how to not live life under a condition of threat level orange, at a personal level and also more globally. Additionally, now the good news, I've been thinking a lot about how our natural resting state in terms of the evolution of the brain is characterized in terms of these three fundamental motivational systems that evolved to avoid threats and harm, approach rewards and opportunities, and third, attach to us, bonding, love, fellowship, the village it takes to raise a child, and so forth. How those three systems have a resting state that's calm, contented, and caring. Calm in terms of avoiding, contented in terms of approaching, and caring in terms of attaching. All right. But we're also evolved hair trigger mechanisms that drive us from that home state, that home base, that resting state, drive us into a reactive mode of fight or flight reactivity. So to sum up, the good news is that our home base is wonderful. The bad news is that we evolved hair trigger mechanisms that are great for short-term crisis management, but lousy for quality of life and lousy for long-term health and well-being. And that gives us a challenge. The good news is that deep down we've got tons and tons of resources. The bad news is we've got to deal with these challenges that are embedded in the caveman brain, which is now armed with nuclear weapons in the 21st century.
That's a great intro, and what I was starting to say is we are surrounded by fear. And I guess my question to you, Rick, is what is driving that?
Okay. So, yeah, well, that's the crux. So think about our ancestors going all the way back. Nervous system's been evolving for 600 million years, 200 million years of mammals, 2.5 million years of tool-making hominid ancestors, whose brains were a third our size. Much of the volume of the brain, tripling over the last several million years, is devoted to social functions. So on that long run, on the one hand, we have a kind of resting state that's summarized for me as calm, contented, and caring. That's the resting state of the brain. That's its home base. That's good news, right? The bad news is that in order to survive and deal with short-term, immediate crises, threats that have an urgency and an impact for survival, we evolved hair trigger mechanisms that drive us from home at the crackle of a twig back in the Serengeti, or these days, a frown across the dinner table or an alarming headline, you know, on the evening news. And that then tips us into this very reactive fight-or-flight mode that's very, very sensitive to threats. You know, if you think about it, that's why I think that one of the most important things a person can do is to help themselves not be gripped by paper tiger paranoia and not needlessly give other people cause to fear them, and clock as many minutes a day as they can in this resting state of the brain, the home base of the brain, because since, quote-unquote, neurons that fire together wire together, when you do clock minutes in that resting state of the brain, you strengthen its neural substrates. So the home base of the brain becomes more and more where you hang out, and in effect, you deepen your keel in the water. So you stay in this centered, calm, contented, caring place, even when you're dealing with stress at work, even when things aren't going well in a team you're managing, even, you know, when you're caught up in some argument at home, you can keep your head together. And for me, that's very good news.
And it is, it's good news for everybody, and you certainly are one of the most enlightened people that I have come to know, and I really appreciate
thank you.
That. So
how
does somebody like you, Rick, make sense of all this madness that's going on in a place like Egypt?
My expertise is inside the brain and also inside the mind of individuals and relationships, so I'm a little careful about the political side, but my own impression is that, you know, factually, it's a pretty classic situation of a strongman dictator propped up in various ways by the U.S. over the years based on short-term gains, but with accumulating long-term costs, because it creates a populace that on the secular side is hungry for, you know, the, you know, modern life and modern media and a modern economy and modern freedoms and modern equality between men and women. And it also creates, you know, a more fundamentalist wing that longs for a return to, you know, traditional ways, in the Muslim Brotherhood and so forth. And, you know, that's, we're seeing that all played out right now. So that's what I think. And it, to me, it speaks to the ways in which, you know, I think deep down, people really do. I go back to Rodney King and the L.A. riots back in the day. I'm old enough to remember him. His plaintive statement, why can't we all just get along? I think deep down, people really do want to get along. And you get these distortions of what people really want based on heavy-handed, short-term, authoritarian rule from the top down. But sooner or later, you're going to pay a price, you know. It might work short term. You're going to win a lot of battles, but ultimately you're going to lose the war. So that's my uninformed, quick take, you know, on a very complex subject.
Well, you know, and I guess the direction that I wanted to go with something like that is really to talk about, you know, the brain and the ability for a nation, starting with individuals, to understand that they have the power to calm their minds.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate what you're saying about that. And, you know, when these tendencies or capacities in the brain to kick into high gear, I think are necessary. You know, I think there's a place for speaking truth to power. There's a place for going out in the street. You know, there's a place for protesting and all the rest of that. And at a more immediate level, I think there's a place in everyday life for, you know, rising to a challenge physically in your life, or, you know, revving up to deal with some business situation, or, you know, coming through for your kids, you know, who really need you late one night. Okay, there's a place for that. The problem is that we have created a kind of lifestyle of chronic, low-grade, fight-or-flight activation. And, you know, the price of that in the business world is really substantial because it lowers productivity, it increases turnover, and increases healthcare costs. Not good, you know? And so if, you know, if the most important asset a company has is the capabilities of its workforce, you know, not paying attention to the long-term consequences, the long-term price of the short-term benefits of kicking into the fight-or-flight reactive mode of the brain, you know, if companies don't pay attention to that, they'll suffer ultimately at the bottom line and shareholder value and all the rest of that. So to me, that's very important to pay attention to. The other thing is to appreciate, just as you're saying, that it's actually easy to tip into a calmer, clearer, more mindful, more fulfilled, more sense of a belonging way of being, you know? It's not that hard to go there, right? And every time we go there, because neurons are fired together, wired together, every time we go there, we strengthen the neural substrate. So how that plays out in a practical way, maybe I'll just offer this for a moment here, how that plays out in a practical way for me in terms of my own practice is to just deliberately help myself feel good. You know, marinating in well-being is incredibly good for the brain and the body and for productivity long term. You know, so when you have an opportunity to take in the good of, you know, everyday small things, you know, little things to be grateful for, little things to recognize that are wholesome and positive in your own nature, you know, little things to appreciate in your own accomplishments or how you're treated over the course of the day, you know, that's an opportunity to reset to the resting state of the brain, this positive home base it has. Another thing is to take a little moment every day to just step out of the madness, you know, find refuge. Every culture has sought sanctuary, has had sanctuaries of one kind or another. And if we don't have some moment, like a pit stop, you know, every day, where we just chill for a minute or 5 minutes or even better, 20 or 40 minutes, you know, gradually over time you get worn down. And then the third and last thing I'll say in passing is really beware the needle on the stress meter moving into orange or red. You know, we can handle a fair amount of ongoing yellow, you know, stress, right? But when you start feeling really pressed or upset, because as you know, when we get upset, it kicks into gear the same stress machinery, you know, that activated to get away from charging lions about, you know, a million years ago. You know, don't let your needle, as best you can, don't let your needle go into the orange or red zone, because that is like metal on metal brake pad grinding. You know, no more brake pads now. You're metal on metal.
Rick, I have two teenage children, one that's about to go to college and one that's going to be a sophomore, and I work really hard with them to really, in fact, I spent a lot of time reviewing your book with them, specifically with this whole notion of teaching them or letting them at least understand that they have the power to take control of their brains.
Yeah.
That's a challenge for most people. What are some simple steps or techniques that you use maybe with your family or yourself, certainly your clients, that ones who are really committed, that can really start to understand that that's possible?
That's a great question. I think that explanations help. To me, that's one of the major benefits of the knowledge explosion about the brain, because it's motivating, broadly defined. In other words, when people get that what they're doing, for better or worse, is changing their own brain, they get more motivated to take practical action, to make positive changes. And they get motivated to be more careful about, you know, those sort of little murmurings in the back of the mind, you know, that are angry or critical or self-critical or you know, resentful or anxious. Because those little murmurings in the back of the mind, neurons are firing together, wiring together, are wiring depression, anxiety, poor resilience, low motivation, et cetera, into the brain. So that's number one. A basic, simple understanding, you know, achieved through reading my book or things like it, you know, that's a good one right there. And I have found, as a generalization, with many exceptions, that two groups in particular benefit from that, namely teenagers and men. All right. Second is to get a grip on the stress machinery of the body and really appreciate that stress is your enemy long term. There's a place for short-term acute stress, being able to manage things and rise and deal and so forth. There's a place for that. But the problem is long-term grinding stress. That's a serious issue. So, you know, being able to initiate a calming response when you start getting worked up or upset, like 3 to 10 long exhalations, or relax the tongue, or call to mind the felt sense of being with someone who cares about you. Those are immediately powerful ways to lower stress-based reactivity. And when people do them a few times, they get much more confidence in that. Like, wow, I can actually do this. This actually works. All right? The third thing I think is a good one, including in particular for teenagers, I alluded to a moment ago, which is this sense of being included or belonging, you know, cared about in a nutshell. And, you know, we evolved to really need that fundamental sense of being cared about. In the Serengeti a million years ago, being separated from the band, exile was a death sentence. I'd read a review last night on the research on loneliness and its very serious negative consequences. I think there are a lot of teenagers who are quite lonely, even though they're surrounded by many other people. So, you know, looking for little moments over the course of the day and maybe at a particular time each day, like just before bed, as a kind of, you know, review for a few minutes of the day, you know, is a very good thing. Looking for these moments where you can legitimately feel cared about is a very positive influence on the brain. And when people experience the benefits of that, just 20 seconds, you know, or even 2 minutes of kind of marinating and feeling seen and liked and appreciated and cared about, maybe even cherished and loved, is a wonderful way to feel better. And as people do that, you know, they get more and more confidence and that they can feel better, and they get more and more motivated to do so.
So, Rick, as whether it's adults or teenagers, start to really think like that, start to grasp the fact that it is possible. Mm-hmm. What does that do for their confidence? What does that do for them moving and shifting a simple behavior like, I can't do this, I can't get great grades or build this business, to just simply, I can or I'll try?
Yeah. Well, I think you said it. In other words, success breeds motivation in a nutshell. And it's very important to, in addition to that obvious platitude, you know, the cliche, it's really important to register success. That's the thing that I would add to it. That's the X factor that makes all the difference in the world. In other words, I'm sure as you do, I've known many people who were quite successful, ranging from, you know, kids in school all the way up to business entrepreneurs, who didn't feel it. It did not really register. They could report it conceptually, but it didn't sink in. It did not stick to their ribs. And because the brain is biased toward really remembering negative experiences, and it tends to ignore positive experiences, it's very important to go out of one's way to really register positive experiences so they really sink in to implicit memory. So that would be the thing that I would add here. When you are successful, whether it's, you know, in your quarterly bottom line or in as a teenager in managing your reactions more skillfully, let's say in some weird social scene at lunch or what have you, or when you are successful, let's say, in, you know, keeping your head in the game and getting your homework done on time and so forth, when you are successful, feel it. Really take the time to enjoy it. You know, there's a fear sometimes people have that if they feel good, that will make them a wuss in some way, or that it's selfish. But actually, much research shows that when people let themselves feel good, A, it builds resilience, and B, they become much more inclined to be caring, patient, generous, and so forth with other people.
Rick, how much does our physical well-being have to do with our mind control?
I think a lot. I mean, there are extraordinary people who are experiencing chronic pain, or they're in a really bad place, but they can surmount it. And I tip my hat to them. And there are, at the other end of the spectrum, there are people who, you know, the least thing really sets them off in a tizzy. The people in the middle, though, where most of us are, definitely are affected by impairments in well-being. You know, I remember reading a literature review of the research on chronic pain, and it compared the negative impact of chronic pain to other, including low-grade chronic pain, like a nagging backache, and it compared it to other negative factors. Chronic pain is the worst, as a generalization for the average person. It's the worst negative factor for mental health. So, you know, as one example. So, yeah, physical well-being, I think, is very important. You know, the mind is woven into the brain, which is woven into the body, which is woven into the world. And when your body's not right, you know, whether it's chronic pain or some kind of funny GI issue or your immune system is inflamed, that feeds back into and harms the brain. For example, recently there's a body of literature that has to do with what's called the cytokine theory of depression. Cytokine is C-Y-T-O-K-I-N-E, if people want to Google this. Anyway, cytokines are chemical messengers released by the immune system when it activates in response to a perceived threat, even if it's no real threat. And one of the major perceived threats that the immune system activates to are foods, for example, that people are actually allergic to, notably the gluten grains and the milk products that were introduced only 10,000 years ago, which is just a blink of the eye in terms of human evolution. So I'm not saying that's true for everybody, but there are people who don't realize that their bodies are actually mounting an immune response reaction that is, you know, inflammatory in the body altogether. It's releasing these chemical messengers. They go into the brain. They cross the blood-brain barrier, and there they, you know, wreak some kind of havoc, including, for example, they make it harder for parts of the brain like the hypothalamus to control the stress response. So they make people more vulnerable to stress, which creates a kind of a cascade of consequences. So the larger point here, and that's just one illustration, is that you're exactly right that bodily well-being promotes mental health. Mm. Exercise, for example, promotes neurogenesis. You know, neurogenesis being the birth of new neurons in the brain. We have roughly 1 to 10,000 new neurons born every day in the brain, mainly in the hippocampus, a part that's involved in visual spatial memory and memory for context. Anyway, especially as you age, you know, one of the things that really helps keep that neurogenesis, you know, baby factory going there, as it were, is regular exercise.
And that's certainly the fact for me. I feel it personally, and that's why I was asking that question. Rick, how about the power of intentions? Much has been said about the power of intentions, and in my opinion, there are sometimes too many fantasies out there, but I know that from a scientific perspective, what can our brains teach us about the power of intentions?
Wow. Well, maybe the context here a little bit is the book of the movie The Secret, and because a lot of people have...
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Yeah, I've been exposed to that. And so I want to make a key distinction here, which, frankly, I think was blurred to really a problematic degree in both the book and the movie. And the distinction is between the power of intention understood in, let's call them, conventional ways. In other words, for example, if I intend to be responsive to your questions rather than go off on some tangent, you know, pitching my new book or whatever like that, you know, then I'm going to have a much more effective interview with you. So there are all kinds of obvious ways. If people intend to exercise, you know, and then if they manifest that intention by creating a regular exercise buddy to get them out and go for a long walk every day or meet at the gym or for Pilates 3 times a week, what have you, they're going to be more successful. There are lots of ways in which, in that conventional way, intention is extremely powerful. I mean, I'm struck as me, someone who has a lot of respect for Buddhism and training there, that, you know, in the Noble Eightfold Path, where the Buddha lays out 8 things, there are only 8, you know, it's a short list, right? 1 of the 8, number 2 on the list in the common sequence, is wise intention. So, you know, intention's really important. Then there's this other way, maybe, that intention may make a difference, and I'll call this one the metaphysical mechanism of action. So the first way is the conventional mechanism of action. The second is the metaphysical. And with regard to that, you know, who knows? It could be true. maybe it's not true. My personal opinion is that there are examples of where metaphysically that intention does seem to have some kind of impact. But I'm not going to argue that point because the evidence for it is, you know, really difficult to pin down in any kind of a scientific way. But to me, it's a truly scientific attitude to have a fundamental open-mindedness and a willingness to be moved by the evidence, you know, as it emerges. That said, whatever might be true about the metaphysical impact of intention, point one, we have plenty of opportunities only focusing on or using the conventional power of intention to radically improve our lives by, for example, waking up in the morning and reestablishing our fundamental purpose in life, which I do routinely, or, for example, writing affirmations out for the day, or, for example, writing out a to-do list and working your to-do list and putting it in front of your face, or, for example, putting stickies around you, you know, on your car or on your computer that have a single word or a phrase on them that really want to keep, or you want to keep in front of your mind, you know, like breathe or be grateful or forgive or whatever it is to you, or bottom line, you know. Those are all very powerful ways to organize intention. Or let's say you're in a conversation with a friend or a mate or a person at work, and it's a difficult conversation. Keep regenerating what actually is the prize in this conversation you're going after, rather than get distracted by all these side issues. Those are all very powerful ways. You know, consider your life purpose, or think of, you know, I have this exercise in my book, Buddha's Brain. I call it the view from the porch, where you just imagine you're doing great, but you're nearing the end of your life. You're looking back, sitting in the rocker at the porch, let's say. What do you want to be really, really glad when you're 90 years old that you did with your life? You know, those are all fantastic ways to use the, you know, what I'm calling conventional power of intention. And whatever might be available to us in terms of manifesting, you know, parking places or green lights or pearl necklaces or the partner of our dreams, you know, through metaphysical mechanisms of action, we have plenty of other opportunity right in front of our nose in terms of conventional forms of intention. Second, I'm nervous. I'm quite uncomfortable about people using things like The Secret to blame themselves or others, frankly, for misfortune. I don't think people get cancer because they intend to get cancer. I don't think children get molested because at some level they intended to get molested. And I don't think the Jews and, you know, and others, gays and others, gypsies and others in World War II got sent to Auschwitz and Dachau, you know, because they at some level intended for that to happen. And I think that, you know, it's easy to misuse teachings that have wisdom in them about the metaphysical power of intention to blame yourself or feel somehow it's your fault, you know, if misfortune befalls you.
Nice. So second that. I mean, absolutely the truth. And,
yeah,
you know, and I love the fact that some of the intentions that you're talking about are simply intentions for us as human beings to remind ourselves to be good people, to tell the truth, to be kind, to be compassionate. Those types of intentions, I know for me personally, definitely impact my brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, well, with regard to the brain, absolutely. I mean, I have a, you know, not to plug my book, but just factually, you know, there's a whole chapter in there.
I want you to plug your book.
Okay. Well, I guess I come up through, you know, a clinical background, also a, you know, Buddhist and a scientific background or academic, and you don't plug yourself. You know what I mean? Like, that's a major no-no in those three cultures, you know, that I've grown up in. So I'll leave it at that. But the truth is that, you know, when we make intentions, we establish them at all levels of the brain, you know, top down in terms of prefrontal cortex using language, or, you know, a kind of an executive focus, like, that says, stick with it, right? You know, don't give up. Hang in there. Strong. You know, whatever that is. Live strong. You know, that's more top down. And then there are also our intentions embedded in the brain bottom up, where we mobilize energy and activation that's rooted in brainstem activations, you know, for good causes, good purposes, good intentions. And we also mobilize, you know, emotionally oriented rewards, a kind of wholeheartedness, a warm-heartedness toward our toward our goals and also mobilize rewards where we feel pleasure or other forms of reward, you know, as we pursue good intentions. So, you know, yeah, those intentions are the power of intention manifests itself throughout all levels of the brain.
Two more questions, Rick, and I'm going to let you go. Tell me about, I know you have some great rituals in your life, but is there a ritual that you can't live without?
Wow, we're going there. I love it. That's good, Mo. You rock. You're going after the real things. It's good. Well, ritual, I would use that word really broadly as, I'll call it routine practice. And it may or may not for a person have a theistic, if you will, component woven into it. I think there are plenty of wonderful rituals that do have a theistic component woven into it. But a person can engage practices routinely, like, for example, just being glad at every meal, that they have a meal, and they're not one of the 1 billion people worldwide, 1 in 6, who goes to bed hungry every night, right? So, okay, that said, whether it has a theistic component or not, I think that, well, in a literal sense, I could live without my rituals, all right? But in the sense, I think you really mean it. They're very high priority for me, and they really keep me going. There are several. One is that I'm committed to meditating a minute or more every day. Usually it's many more minutes than one, but that's a personal commitment. That's a vow. So I don't go to bed without meditating. Sometimes it's 1:30 in the morning. I've ground through a huge inbox worth of emails, and I'm just exhausted. But, you know, I'm going to sit up in bed for 2 or 3 minutes breathing and relaxing before I go to sleep because that's my commitment. Second commitment is that almost every day I very consciously reestablish my purpose in life, my overarching most fundamental purpose, which for me is about awakening my own and others, and take refuge. For me, refuge is, you know, in Buddhism, it's the teacher, the teaching, and the community of the taught, or in traditional language, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. There are other refuges that people can take, and I take as well. Like, I take refuge in practice. Just keep going. Or I take refuge in the divine, myself. I take refuge in awareness. I take refuge in interdependence, the fact that everything's connected to everything else and nothing arises on its own. So those are refuges for me. And in addition to that, people can take refuge in things like the memory of their grandmother's kitchen, you know, baking cookies, or the felt sense of being loved, or take refuge in reason, or take refuge in knowing that they're fundamentally a good person, you know, no halo required. Whatever it is, you know, I think that in this very challenging life at any time in history, there always are challenges, you know. Life has difficulties, no doubt about it. We need refuges, right? We need pit stops of one kind or another. So I'd say that. I think the last thing is I really do go through my day, you know, trying to vacuum up at least some of the many little pearls strewn around me. Everyone's life has, you know, dozens and dozens, hundreds maybe every day of little pearls strewn around them, little opportunities to legitimately feel good. You know, feeling good being fairly mild in most cases. On the 0 to 10 scale of feeling good, it's a plus 0.3 or a plus 1 or a plus 2 or 3 or 4. But there are, you know, dozens and dozens of pearls in front of us every day. You know, recognition of accomplishments, recognition of things to be grateful for, recognition of people being nice to us and so forth. And I really, you know, I try not to leave money on the table. I really want to suck up those pearls and weave those pearls into the fabric of my brain and my being. And I would say that is something I don't think I can do without on any given day. It doesn't mean looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. It means seeing the world clearly, both the real tigers, but also the dozens of pearls, you know, that are right there in front of us each day.
You are an absolutely remarkable person, and I am really,
really... I don't
know
if that's true, but thank you.
...to have you in my life. My last question to you is this. Obviously, your book has had a tremendous impact on me, and I'm sure on you just going through the process. But other than your own work, what other book or individual has had the greatest impact on you?
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I've had a number of teachers along the way that have had a big impact. I've also had a lot of really powerful, wholesome influences in my life that did not have the teacher name tag. Both people like my wife, who's had a wonderful influence on me over the years, as well as situations or people like my children who themselves have had wonderful influence on me and have led to wonderful influences on me. So part one. And I think that's true for everyone. Well, you and everyone, I think that's generally true. If I were to call out a couple of things that could be key resources to people perhaps listening to this, in the world of the brain, let's say, and, you know, ways of feeling better in life, I'll tell you the books. How about this one? I'll answer the question this way. I'll tell you the books I most often recommend to people, all right? Number one, in no particular order, okay, I would recommend Jon Kabat-Zinn's masterpiece, Wherever You Go, There You Are. Fantastic, basic, highly accessible book on mindfulness. Second, I recommend Nonviolent Communication by Marshall Rosenberg as a wonderful book about very practical skills in communication with others and a way of interacting with others that solves problems and, you know, puts out fires and prevents wars, Nonviolent Communication. Third book would be the classic book Focusing by Eugene Gendlin about self-awareness and using the power of self-awareness to heal and release inner pain of one kind or another. I would totally recommend those books. And then, this is a book not for the faint of heart, but for those who are really into this sort of thing. I just think it's a masterpiece. Evan Thompson's book called Mind in Life, in which he, a world-class philosopher of science and someone who is deeply knowledgeable as well as way brilliant about neuropsychology and biology, has really written a tour de force that grounds the mind in biology. About a third of his book is a lot of phenomenological philosophy, which is not so much my cup of tea, but the chapters that are, I'm not saying anything against it, I tended to flip through those pages, but the pages that really spoke to me were when he just goes through the latest neuroscience and how mind emerges, you know, in life, and in a way that's interdependently arising. So I think that's great. And then I'll do one last pitch for a book and then I'll shut up, which is, If people are at all interested in what the Buddha actually taught, a marvelous book is called In the Buddha's Words, which is kind of a greatest hits of the Buddha. And the author and translator of it is Bhikkhu Bodhi, last name Bodhi. You can get it on Amazon and elsewhere. It's a wonderful summary. It's an anthology he's, to me, gold standard translator of early Buddhist teachings, of very, very practical, fundamentally down-to-earth teachings of the Buddha in plain English. You know, I myself would always rather read the saints than the theologians, you know, and Bhikkhu Bodhi has done an incredible job, a unique job, in presenting the fundamental teachings of the Buddha in very accessible language and in a very well-organized way. You know, if I were stuck on a desert island and could have only five Buddhist books with me, it would definitely be in the top five.
Well, and then could you please wrap up and plug your own stuff, because we're going to make sure that this type of conversation is in front of the right people who really appreciate and embrace this. And we've talked last time about the website, buddhasbrain.com, which takes you to your website. Tell me how people can continually get more of your information.
Well, I appreciate that, Mo, a lot. And you know, wrapping up, one thing that has struck me is how mental training of one kind or another, I'll say two things. First, people routinely understand that if they want to get a result in, say, business or their golf game or, you know, landscape in their yard or, you know, getting fit, they understand they have to work for it. Okay, good. You do. You have to work for it, you know. On the other hand, when it comes to the mind, you know, thoughts and feelings and how they are with their kids or their mate or, you know, their emotions, their reactions, they sort of don't get it that you actually have to work as well in that domain to produce a result. But, you know, what's true with regard to, you know, building a muscle in a gym or building a business from scratch is also true with regard to improving, you know, your well-being and functioning and interpersonal, you know, behavior. So that's point one. Point two, with regard to that mental training, it's often struck me kind of weird that people can think that various kinds of mental training, whether it's in the Western traditions of psychology or in the Eastern traditions of contemplative practice, they sort of think that that training is soft, mushy, I'm going to use a loaded word here, feminine, quote-unquote, new age, blah-de-blah, navel-gazing, and so forth, whereas I think it's tough as nails. I think the hardest thing in the world is to really take your own mind on and, you know, gradually, you know, tame that buck and bronco and learn how to ride it more skillfully. So I think that if people really appreciate that it's tough-minded and it's about real old-fashioned values of resilience, grit, gumption, drive, delaying of gratification, you know, patience and other virtues and things like that, it's really useful for entrepreneurs, business owners, and everybody to appreciate that mental training is actually tough as nails. So on the basis of that, I will